We would be remiss today if we didn't note the death on Wednesday of Howard Zinn. I met him in the late 50s when he was chair of the history department at Spelman College. As you know, he encouraged his students in the larger Atlanta University Center complex to confront the segregation system they saw in Atlanta. And when the sit-in mania hit Atlanta, his students and others were ready. He became an advisor to the embryonic Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he wrote the first book on SNCC called SNCC, The New Abolitionist. He lived a remarkable life as a scholar activist, and we're all in his debt today. And I'd also be remiss if I didn't repeat an announcement I made earlier in the morning about the upcoming 50th anniversary reunion conference of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to be held in Raleigh from April 16th to 18th of this year. Howard Zinn had agreed to be a speaker. And I'd finally be remiss if I didn't introduce two of my colleagues from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee who are here today, Joan Browning from West Virginia, and Charles Sherrod from Albany, Georgia, who will speak to us tomorrow. Now, my remarks are entitled, What We Did. I want to begin with a quotation from Ella Baker. She said, strong people don't need strong leaders. We were strong people. We did strong things. And I want to talk about some of the things we did. This began for me, as it did for many, many more. On February 4th, 1960, I was sitting in a cafe near my college campus in Atlanta, Georgia, a place where students went between or instead of classes. A student named Lonnie King approached me. He held up a copy of that day's Atlanta Daily World, Atlanta's daily black newspaper. The headline read, Greensboro Students Sit In for Third Day. It told in exact detail how black college students from North Carolina A&T University in Greensboro had for the third day in a row entered a Woolworths department store and asked for service at the whites-only lunch counter. It described their demeanor, their dress, their determination to return the following day, and as many successive days as it took if they were not served. Have you seen this? He demanded. Yes, I have, I replied. What do you think about it? He asked. I think it's great, I said. Don't you think it ought to happen here? He asked. I said, I'm sure it will happen here. Surely someone here will do it. And then to me, as it came to others in those early days of 1960, a query, an invitation, and a command, he said, why don't we make it happen here? And before I could say, what do you mean we? King, Joe Pierce, and I canvassed the cafe, talking to students, inviting them to discuss the Greensboro event and to duplicate it in Atlanta. The Atlanta student movement had begun. We formed an organization, we reconnoitered downtown lunch counters, and within a week, 77 of us had been arrested. In an early 1960s freedom song, the young people who joined together to create the Southern student movement were described in this way. You know, I debated with myself whether I should sing this. My wife said no. But I heard cries of yes. I sing this one verse. It goes, the time was 1960, the place the USA. February 1st became the history-making day. From Greensboro across the land, the news spread far and wide. As quietly and bravely, youth took a giant stride. Heed the call, Americans all, side by equal side. Brothers, sit in dignity. Sisters, sit in pride. In pride, in pride. Yeah, that's enough. Yeah. As a former President Jimmy Carter told SNCC worker Mary King, if you wanted to scare white people in Southwest Georgia, Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian leadership wouldn't do it. You only had to say one word, SNCC. As John F. Kennedy said, compared to Martin Luther King's SCLC, SNCC workers were real sons of bitches. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was founded in Raleigh, North Carolina in 1960 by Southern student protesters engaged in sit-in demonstrations against lunch counter segregation. Within a year, the organization evolved from a coordinating committee to a hands-on organization, helping local leadership in rural and small-town communities across the South, helping them participate in a variety of protests and political and economic organizing campaigns, setting SNCC apart from the civil rights mainstream of the 1960s. Its members, its youth, its independence enabled the organization to remain close to grassroots currents that rapidly escalated the Southern movement from sit-ins to freedom rides to voter drives to political organizing. By 1965, SNCC fielded the largest staff of any civil rights organization operating in the South. It had organized nonviolent direct action against segregated facilities and voter registration projects in Alabama, Arkansas, Maryland, Missouri, Louisiana, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Illinois, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Texas, and Mississippi. It had built two independent political parties. It had organized labor unions and agricultural co-ops. It gave the movement for women's liberation new energy. It inspired and trained the activists who began the New Left. It helped expand the limits of political debate within Black America, and it broadened the focus of the civil rights movement. Unlike mainstream groups, which merely sought integration of Blacks into the existing order, SNCC sought structural changes in American society itself. In 1960, the dominant organization fighting for civil rights was the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Its preferred method was litigation, and it achieved its greatest victory in 1954 in Brown v. the Board of Education. The NAACP lobbied Congress and presidents to adopt anti-segregation measures. Its local branches were often the main civil rights outpost in many communities. The NAACP and many similar groups and many individuals fought against a tripartite system of racial domination, which whites had solidified over time. Ironically, a consequence of the segregation system was the development of close-knit communities, communities of institutions, churches, schools, and organizations, which nurtured and encouraged the fight against white supremacy. The young people who began the 1960 student sit-in movement lived and learned among such institutions. The movement's goals were described to the Democratic Convention's Platform Committee in 1960 by SNCC's first chairman, Marion Barry, as seeking a community in which man can realize the full meaning of self, which demands open relationships with others. He declared Southern students wanted an end to racial discrimination in housing, education, employment, and voting. SNCC's goals were similarly broadly described by Executive Secretary James Forman in 1961 as working full-time against the whole value system of the country and by working toward revolution. In 1963, he described as a program of developing, building, and strengthening indigenous leadership, and by third SNCC Chairman John Lewis at the 1963 March on Washington as building a serious social revolution against American politics dominated by politicians who build their careers on immoral compromises and ally themselves with open forms of political, economic, and social exploitation. SNCC pioneered first-time races by Blacks in the 1960s Deep South, added foreign policy demands to the Black political agenda, and broadened the acceptable limits of political discourse. SNCC was in the vanguard in demonstrating that independent Black politics could be successful. Its early attempts to use Black candidates to raise issues where victory was unlikely, expanded the political horizon. SNCC's development of independent political parties mirrored the philosophy that political form must follow function and that non-hierarchical organizations were essential to counter the growth of personality cults and self-reinforcing leadership. For much of its early history, SNCC battled against the fear, which kept Southern rural Blacks from aggressively organizing and acting in their own behalf. It strengthened or built aggressive, locally led movements in the communities where it worked. While organizing grassroots voter registration drives, SNCC workers offered themselves as a protective barrier between private and state-sponsored terror and the local communities where they lived and worked. The rural South SNCC entered in 1961 had a long history of civil rights activism. In many instances, however, SNCC staffers were the first paid civil rights workers to base themselves in isolated rural communities, daring as it was reported then, to take the message of freedom into areas where the bigger civil rights organizations feared to tread. SNCC workers were more numerous and less transient than those from other civil rights organizations, and their method of organization was different as well. The NAACP was outlawed in Alabama in 1956 and did not begin operating there again until 1964, although NAACP activists continued under other sponsorship. In 1962, the NAACP had one field secretary each in South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, and a regional staff headquartered in Atlanta. One historian writes, SCLC had to adopt a strategy of hit and run, striking one target at a time. SCLC's willingness to run as well as to hit provoked consistent criticism from SNCC, which organized the same communities for years rather than months or weeks. SNCC mobilized, someone said. SNCC organized. By spring of 1963, SNCC had 11 staff members in southwest Georgia and 20 staff with 6 offices in Mississippi. By August, SNCC had projects and a permanent staff in a dozen Mississippi communities in Selma, Alabama, Danville, Virginia, and Pine Bluff, Arkansas. There were 12 workers in the Atlanta headquarters, 60 field secretaries, and 121 full-time volunteers. Typically, SNCC began campaigns by researching the economic and political history of a target community. Field workers were supplied with detailed information on a community's economic and financial power structure, tracing corporate relations from local bankers and business leadership in a local white citizen council to the largest American banks and corporations. Other research provided the economic and political status of a state's black population. SNCC organizers spent their first weeks in a new community, meeting local leadership, formulating with them an action plan for more aggressive registration efforts, and recruiting new activists through informal conversation, painstaking house-to-house canvassing, and regular mass meetings. Registering rural Southern blacks, a SNCC worker wrote, would greatly liberate American politics as a whole. At the very least, these new voters would defeat the powerful, hidebound Southern Democrats who were holding the reins of Congress and the Senate on the basis of being elected year after year from districts where black citizens were denied the franchise. SNCC and other organizations fought white terror and helped create a willingness to risk danger to register to vote. By one estimate, a majority of the unregistered had at least been confronted with registration's challenge by 1965. SNCC's broader definition of the civil rights movement's purposes was obvious from its beginnings. At its founding conference in April 1960, SNCC Executive Committee member Charles Jones declared, "This movement will affect other areas beyond lunch counter services, such as politics and economics." A report from the founding conference concluded with a warning about America's false preoccupations in early 1960. It said, "Civil defense and economic power alone will not secure the continuation of democracy. Democracy itself demands the great intangible strength of the people, able to unite in a common endeavor because they are granted human dignity. This challenge cannot be met unless and until all Americans enjoy the full promise of our democratic heritage, first-class citizenship." Another recommendation noted, "Students have a natural claim to leadership in this project. They have pioneered in nonviolent direct action. Now we can show we understand the political implications of our movement that goes far beyond lunch counters. We're convinced of the necessity of all local areas joining in a campaign to secure the right to vote. No right is more basic to the American citizen, none more basic in a democracy." Within 4 months of these declarations, SNCC volunteer worker Robert Moses was planning a student staff voter registration project in all Black Mountain Bayou in the Mississippi Delta for the summer of 1961. Mississippi, the most resistant state, became a laboratory for SNCC's unique methods of organizing. SNCC's work began in southwest Mississippi in 1961, but when its workers were driven from the area by violence, state suppression, and federal indifference, the organization regrouped in Jackson and Mississippi's Delta counties in early 1962. Earlier in 1961, SNCC's Nashville affiliate had continued the Corps-sponsored freedom rides when Alabama violence threatened to bring them to a halt. After they were released from Parchman Penitentiary, many jail riders had joined the McComb movement. Several became part of the organizing cadre for the Mississippi movement that followed. Unencumbered by allegiances to the National Democratic Party, which frequently constrained other older organizations, SNCC encouraged two black candidates to run for Congress. Bob Moses served as unofficial campaign manager. They ran to shake loose the fear among Mississippi blacks, and through their progressive platforms, gave their intended constituents an expanded notion of what meaning politics might have in their lives. They talked of matters which white Mississippi politicians had never dreamed of mentioning, ideas which resonate today. Legislation improving the school system, a broader plan of medical coverage, special training facilities to develop industrial skills among the great mass of Mississippians who lack these completely. To demonstrate, the disenfranchised Mississippi branch, Mississippi blacks, did want to register, did want to vote, SNCC mounted a Freedom Vote campaign in November 1963. Over 80,000 blacks cast mock votes in a mock election for governor and lieutenant governor. 100 northern white students worked in this campaign, attracting attention from the Department of Justice and the national media, as black registration workers had never done, paving the way for the Freedom Summer campaign of 1964. Freedom Summer brought almost 1,000 mostly white volunteers to Mississippi for the summer of 1964. They helped build the new political party SNCC had organized, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. They registered voters. They staffed 28 freedom schools, intended by their designer, Charles Cobb, to provide an education which will make it possible for them to challenge the myths of our society, to perceive more clearly its realities, and to find alternatives and ultimately new directions for action. Over the next several years, SNCC-backed candidates for Congress ran in Albany, Georgia, Selma, Alabama, Danville, Virginia, and Enfield, North Carolina. SNCC helped candidates for Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Services boards in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, North Carolina, and Mississippi. It aided school board candidates in Arkansas in 1965 and worked towards solving the economic problems of the Southern Negro by organizing the Mississippi Freedom Labor Union and Poor People's Corporation and mounting economic boycotts against discriminatory merchants. Among SNCC's contribution to electoral politics were the formation of two political parties and the conception and implementation of my successful campaigns for the Georgia State Legislature. The MFDP challenged the seating of the regular all-white delegation from Mississippi at the 1964 Democratic Convention, and in 1965 challenged the seatings of Mississippi's congressional delegation in Washington. The convention challenge ended in failure when pressures from President Lyndon Johnson erased promised support from party liberals. An offer was made and rejected of two convention seats to be filled by the National Party, not by the Freedom Democrats. As Fannie Lou Hamer famously declared, "We didn't come for no two seats, because all of us is tired." Each challenge served as an object lesson for strengthening black political independence, and the organizing and lobbying efforts for each laid the groundwork for congressional passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The MFDP served as a prototype for the model of black power advocated and popularized by Stokely Carmichael. In 1965, the McComb MFDP branch became the first black political organization to express opposition to the war in Vietnam. State MFDP officials not only refused to repudiate the McComb statement, they reprinted it in the state MFDP newsletter, giving it wider circulation and laying the groundwork for future black opponents of the war. The MFDP's legal efforts against white resistance to political equality proved important to black political efforts across the South. An MFDP-directed court suit resulted in the Supreme Court's landmark 1969 decision in Allen versus State Board of Elections, critical to continuing black political progress throughout the South. For the first time, the Supreme Court recognized and applied the principle of minority vote dilution, that the black vote can be affected as much by dilution as by absolute prohibition on casting a ballot. But the MFDP wasn't the only organization SNCC helped to build, and not the only one that survived the demise of the parent. In 1964, SNCC encouraged a group of New York progressives and health professionals to form a group to provide health care to workers in the Freedom Summer campaign. Most of them were veterans of past attempts to organize physicians to push for integration of the AMA's segregated Southern affiliates and of sporadic attempts to win support for national health insurance. They call their new organization the Medical Committee for Human Rights. Wherever there was a demonstration or confrontation, historian John Dittmer writes, be it at the Edmund Pettus Bridge outside Selma, or on the Meredith March in the South, in Resurrection City with the Poor People's Campaign, at Columbia University during the Student Rebellion, in the streets of Chicago outside the Democratic National Convention, at Wounded Knee with the American Indian Movement, men and women in white coats and Red Cross armbands were on the scene, providing medical presence and assistance to the people who were putting themselves at risk. Throughout it all, Dittmer writes, medical committee activists were in agreement that health care in the United States was inadequate, unjust, racist, and in need of major overhaul. Their members established free health clinics in inner cities, created the model for the Comprehensive Health Center. They campaigned for National Health Service that would provide quality health for everyone. They stimulated consumer participation in health affairs. They successfully pressured medical schools to add programs in family and community medicine and to admit more black and female students. Their lobbying directly influenced passage of health care legislation and implementation of federal programs. It was then on the creation of the Model for Comprehensive Community Health Center that MCHR made the most important contribution to the well-being of impoverished Americans. By 2009, nearly 1,300 centers were providing primary care for more than 16 million Americans at 7,000 sites in urban and rurally medically underserved communities across the nation. The mid-1960s were a turning point in the Southern human rights struggle. The 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 accomplished the immediate goals of many in the civil rights movement. SNCC worker Cleveland Sellers wrote, when the federal government passed bills that supposedly supported black voting and outlawed public segregation, SNCC lost the initiative in these areas. Northern urban riots in the late 1960s made the nation and Southern civil rights workers aware that victories at lunch counters and ballot boxes meant little to blacks locked in northern ghettos. SNCC had long believed that works ought to be expanded to larger cities in the South and outside the region. Executive Committee minutes from December 1963 quote Foreman asserting, SNCCers have to go into poor sections of large cities to work. My campaign for the Georgia House of Representatives was an attempt in 1965 to take the techniques SNCC had learned in the rural South to an urban setting and to carry forward SNCC's belief that grassroots politics could provide answers to problems faced by America's urban blacks. In keeping with SNCC's style, a platform was developed in consultation with the voters. The campaign supported a minimum wage of $2 an hour, repeal of the right to work law, and abolition of the death penalty. When the legislature twice rejected me, objecting to my support of SNCC's anti-war position, the resulting two campaigns gave SNCC a chance to successfully test its critique of American imperialism at the ballot box. Like the MFDP, the campaign enabled SNCC to provide a political voice to the politically impotent and inarticulate black poor. In 1966 in Alabama, SNCC helped to create a black political party called the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, an independent political party which would prove to be a factor in Alabama politics for years to come. The party was formed in reaction to the racism of local and state Democratic parties. Like the MFDP, the new party was open to whites, but no whites in Lowndes County would participate in a black-dominated political effort. Concurrently with the organizing effort of the MFDP and the LCFO and the Bond Campaign, SNCC was reassessing its concentration on the South. At a retreat in May of 66, Ivan O. Donaldson argued in favor of SNCC's replicating its successful Southern political organization efforts in the South, and the staff agreed. Donaldson and Robert Moses suggested that techniques learned in the Southern campaigns could be employed to ease SNCC's passage into Northern cities. Michael Thelwell proposed in 1966 that the organization, quote, move to the ghetto and organize those communities to control themselves. The organization must be attempted in Northern and Southern areas, as well as at the rural black belt of the South. Projects were established in Washington, D.C. to fight for home rule, in Columbus, Ohio, where a community foundation was organized, in New York City's Harlem, where SNCC workers organized early efforts at community control of public schools, in Los Angeles, where SNCC helped to monitor local police and joined an effort at creating a freedom city in black neighborhoods, in Chicago, where SNCC workers began to build an independent political party and demonstrate against segregated schools. In each of these cities, the Southern experiences of SNCC organizers informed their work. As SNCC chair, Marion Barry had written members of Congress in 1960 to urge immediate action to provide self-government to the voteless residents of our nation's capital, the District of Columbia. In February 1966, Barry, then director of SNCC's Washington office, announced the formation of the Free D.C. movement. He wrote, "The premise is we want to organize black people for black power." Barry and the FDMCM conducted a special boycott of Washington merchants who did not support home rule. In New York, SNCC worker Bill Hall helped a Harlem group working for community control of Intermediate School No. 201 in fall of 1966. His work laid the groundwork for later successful protests for community control of schools throughout the city. In Los Angeles, SNCC worker Cliff Vaughs described his work as a manifestation of self-help, determination, and power for poor people. Just as a concern for social change had never been limited to the southern states alone, SNCC's concern for human rights had long extended beyond the borders of the United States. It had linked the fight of American blacks with the struggle for African independence from its very first public statements. At its founding statements, it announced its identification with the African liberation struggle. It said, "We identify with ourselves with the African struggle as a concern for all mankind." At their fall 1960 conference in Atlanta, a featured speaker was Alfonso Cucu, an Antioch College student and brother of Kenyan labor leader Tom Mboya. The mass meeting program said, "Okuku brings to our attention the great significance of the African struggle and its relationship to our fight." SNCC Chairman John Lewis told the March on Washington in 1963, "One man, one vote is the African cry. It must be ours." In December 1963, SNCC workers in Atlanta conferred with Kenya leader Oginga Odinga, and in September 1964, an 11-member SNCC delegation went to Guinea as guest of that country's president, Sekou Touré. Two members of the group toured Africa for a month after the Guinea trip. In October 1965, two SNCC workers represented the organization at the annual meeting of the Organization of African Unity in Ghana. SNCC's January 1966 anti-war statement charged the United States with being deceptive in claiming control for freedom of colored people in such countries as the Dominican Republic, the Congo, South Africa, and the United States itself. Singer Harry Belafonte organized a supportive reception at the United Nations with 15 African diplomats in early 1966. And in March 22, 1966, seven SNCC workers were arrested at the South African consulate in New York City, preceding by 20 years the Free South Africa movement that later saw hundreds arrested at the South African embassy in Washington. At a June 1967 staff meeting, SNCC declared itself a human rights organization, dedicated to the liberation not only of black people in the United States, but of all oppressed people, especially those in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. SNCC's chair, Stokely Carmichael, visited Algeria, Syria, Egypt, Guinea, and Tanzania in mid-67. In November 67, Foreman testified for SNCC before the UN's Fourth Committee against American investment in South Africa. There are many, many reasons for the demise of this important organization. The current of nationalism, ever present in black America, widened at the end of the 1960s to become a rushing torrent which swept away the hopeful notion of black and white together that the decade's beginning had promised. SNCC's white staff members were asked to devote their energies to organizing in white communities. Some agreed, but many believed this action repudiated the movement's hopeful call to Americans all side by equal side. For many on the staff, both white and black, nearly a decade's worth of hard work at irregular subsistence-level pay, under an atmosphere of constant terror, interrupted by jailings, beatings, and official and private terror, proved to be too much. When measured by the legislative accomplishments of the 1964 Civil Rights and 1965 Voting Rights Act, SNCC's efforts were successful. But the failure of the Mississippi Democratic Party to gain recognition in Atlantic City predicted the coming collapse of support from white liberals. The murders of four schoolgirls in Birmingham, Medgar Evers in Jackson in 1963, civil rights workers and others in Mississippi in 1964, Martin Luther King in 1968, argued that violence was no antidote to a violent, that nonviolence was no antidote to a violent society. The outbreak of urban violence at the decade's end further produced a sense of frustration and alienation in many SNCC veterans. Throughout its brief history, SNCC insisted on group-centered leadership and community-based politics. It made clear the connection between economic power and racial oppression. It refused to define racism as solely Southern, to describe racial inequality as caused by irrational prejudice alone, or to limit the struggle solely to guaranteeing legal equality. It challenged American imperialism while mainstream civil rights organizations were silent or curried favor with President Johnson, condemning SNCC's linkage of domestic poverty and racism with overseas adventurism. SNCC refused to apply political tests to its membership or supporters, opposing the red baiting which other organizations and leaders endorsed or condoned. It created an atmosphere of expectation and anticipation among the people with whom it worked, trusting them to make decisions about their own lives. It widened the definition of politics beyond campaigns and elections. For SNCC, politics encompassed not only electoral races, but also organizing political parties, labor unions, producer co-ops, and alternative schools. It initially sought to liberalize Southern politics by organizing and enfranchising blacks. One proof of its success was the increase in black elected officials in the Southern states from 72 in 1965 to 388 in 1968. But it also sought to liberalize the ends of political participation by enlarging the issues of political debate to include the economic and foreign policy concerns of American blacks. SNCC's articulation and advocacy of black power redefined the relationship between black Americans and white power. No longer would political equity be considered a privilege, it had become a right. One SNCC legacy is the destruction of the psychological shackles which had kept black Southerners in physical and mental peonage. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee helped to break these chains forever. It demonstrated that ordinary women and men, young and old, could perform extraordinary tasks. They did so then and can do so again. What began 50 years ago is not just history. It was part of a mighty movement that started many years before that and continues on to this day. Ordinary women, ordinary men, proving they can perform extraordinary tasks in the pursuit of freedom. Thank you.